Lead poisoning continues to be the number one environmental poison for children in New York State. Lead is highly toxic and most harmful to children in their early years. Elevated blood levels can trigger serious health conditions, ranging from gastrointestinal symptoms to chronic kidney inflammation or even convulsions. And there's a strong link between these high lead levels and reduced IQ and behavioral problems. Well, joining us this morning to help us better understand these dangers and what can be done about it is Dr. Howard Weinberger, professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of the Central Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Resource Center. Good morning, Dr. Weinberger.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
So let's begin with the basic. Help us understand, what is lead exactly to begin with, and what is lead poisoning?
Well, lead is an element that's found in nature all over. It's extremely valuable. It's used in industry. It has been used in industry for thousands of years. The Romans used it in plumbing. The atomic number for lead is Pb, which is lead. It's from plumbing. So we know that lead has been used for many years, and we also know its toxicity for many years. I found an article that Benjamin Franklin wrote 200 years ago in which he demonstrated a common knowledge that painters and plumbers were affected by lead, developed severe neurological problems when they weren't aware of the dangers of it.
That's fascinating. So it's been a very useful element.
It's very useful and still used.
But
it's
hazardous.
It's used in computers. It's used in industry all over. And the bad part about lead is it doesn't deteriorate. So it doesn't decay.
So what is poisoning when we talk about lead poisoning? What are we talking about?
Well, that's a good question because unfortunately now, fortunately, I should say, the story in this country is that it's really a public health success story. We've seen over the last 40 years a marked reduction in the number of children affected by lead for a variety of reasons, which hopefully we'll get into. But lead, when it gets into the body, does affect, as you said before, almost every intestinal system, a blood-forming system, and the central nervous system, and that's the part that we worry about the most. The definition of lead poisoning actually has changed over the last 40 years, so that the Centers for Disease Control actually have recorded what they consider an acceptable level of lead. There is no such thing as a normal blood level, and nobody should have lead in their body at all. It doesn't have any value. It's not like iron, which we need.
For hemoglobin and blood and oxygen transfer.
Exactly. So any amount of lead is abnormal, but the acceptable level used to be listed as something like 40 to 60 micrograms per deciliter. It's now 10. So we've done a good job of removing lead from the atmosphere. Lead was removed from gasoline in the 1970s, and that was probably the most effective public health measure we've had for the issue of lead poisoning.
Because it was coming mostly from those sources, would you say?
Well, it was leaded gasoline. It was creating a huge problem for everybody, not just children, but everybody in the country. And then in the late 70s, there was legislation limiting the amount of lead that could be used in household paint. And that has been a big help in terms of future how homes that were built after the 1970s.
So you're exposed to it through either dust or ingesting it in some way through the digestive tract?
Yeah, the primary source for children right now is still leaded paint because many old homes still exist. In fact, a study has been done in New York State and the cities in upstate New York. Just about 75% of the homes were built before the 1970s. So we have a huge reservoir of housing stock that's had leaded paint on the outside as well as on the inside. And as the paint deteriorates, as it peels and as it crumbles, it becomes dust, which is common in window frames, or the paint chips themselves become accessible to young children. And unfortunately, children are attracted by those little paint chips. They look like potato chips. You take one, it actually has a sweet taste to it. So a toddler picks one up, tastes it, has a little sweet taste. It's more attractive, may take a second one and a third one. And depending on how much leaded paint is on one of those chips, you can actually get a fair amount of lead poisoning that way.
So you have said that when you say that the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, has now come out with a suggestion of lowering what's acceptable.
That's right.
Well, what kind of impact does that have, actually?
Well, the most recent recommendation was an advisory committee that recommended reducing the acceptable level to 5 micrograms per deciliter, which will create a significant problem, because for the health departments around the country, they do a fair amount of follow-up of every child who has an elevated lead level. For example, in this county, a home visit is mandated every time a child is identified who has a lead level of, I think it's 15 right now. And that's very effective, because most of us don't do home visits anymore. Most physicians don't. So the health department will go in and check out the environment, see what the risks are. And if it's a landlord, they get a list of all of the hazards that have to be fixed afterwards. So that's what we call secondary prevention. In other words, you measure a child's blood lead level, and if it's elevated, then you try to prevent continued exposure. So that's secondary prevention.
It's interesting, though. We did an interview not too long ago with a gentleman who was doing research in environmental toxins for children. And I asked him about how countries like China fare in this kind of whole world. And what he suggested, and I think it's very interesting, is that it's really almost a political decision, or there's political will behind setting these levels and determining what is acceptable toxicity and what is not. And here you're suggesting the same is true, that it really requires some kind of regulatory agency to come out and say, we have to lower these levels of acceptability. Otherwise, we're basically allowing, and in China, the point was that they had very high levels of acceptability, you know, that people could be exposed to all kinds of toxins without any recourse.
My understanding is they don't measure them.
Or maybe they don't measure them at all,
and
right.
It's not just China, but it's a number of different countries around the world do not have the same kind of standards. I mean, our EPA has set significant standards in terms of pollution. There are countries that still use leaded gasoline. So children coming from other countries are often exposed to lead in ways that our children in this country no longer get exposed environmentally. You're absolutely right.
So I'm going to ask you to hold on to that thought, because we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back with more from Dr. Weinberger. So please stay with us. On air, Linda Cohen along with Dr. Howard Weinberger, and we're talking about lead poisoning in children. So before the break, we were talking about the fact that, we do have more regulation here in this country and perhaps are therefore protecting our children, but it was shocking to me to read that lead poisoning continues to be the number one environmental poison for children, especially in New York State. So why is that?
Well, in one way, it's because we can measure it. I think that's you can't measure broken windows. You can't measure hazards like wires that are loose. It's hard to measure, in fact, even for environmental issues that affect the asthma, which is a very common problem in children.
A growing problem, too.
A severe problem. But it's hard to measure the asthma level. So lead is good in that way, because you can actually get a number. You get a measurement, and that's helpful. Sometimes, in fact, it's very difficult. We explain to a parent that your child has an elevated blood lead level, and from all intents and purposes, that child looks and acts perfectly fine. So to say your child is lead poisoned suggests something is going to be very obvious. There's no rash. There's no symptoms for most children, fortunately, because, as I said, it's been a real public health success. Early on, children who had lead poisoning were only identified if they had seizures, as you mentioned earlier, or convulsions, or even died. So those cases, fortunately, we don't see very often in this country anymore. In fact, most children that we identify with elevated lead levels have no ostensible symptoms.
But that still doesn't mean that they won't necessarily suffer some degree of damage?
No, exactly. If you look at population studies, not on individual children, but population studies, clearly children who have even mildly elevated, and I say mildly elevated blood lead levels, have lower IQs, they have more behavior problems, they have more dropouts in school, there's even some link to delinquency in teenagers. I mean, these are population studies. You can't say that in any one individual child, but if you look at populations, there clearly are those kinds of connections.
So I want to talk about how to mitigate this and or how to prevent it, but let me start out by saying, who are the ones who are most at risk then?
Well, the most children at risk, of course, are the young kids. As you said earlier, it's the developing brain is what's going to be most affected by lead exposure. Although I must tell you, the adults who work in leaded industries get lead poisoning.
Well, you mentioned the plumbers and
I mean, and that's still a problem in occupational health. We have an occupational health program here at Upstate. They do still see adults who are exposed to lead in a variety of different ways. But, you know, my interest, of course, is with children.
But the fact is that, as you said, the developing brain is going to be more susceptible.
Absolutely.
And also kids are, you know, that sounds to me like you were mentioning before about little toddlers being attracted by lead chips. I mean, they're on the floor, they're crawling around. If there's lead dust around, they're more apt to ingest it or inhale it.
Yeah, I always make the point that it's really a developmentally connected disease, that if you're under a year of age, it's not as likely to get lead poison because your children are not as mobile. It's the second year of life, actually, which is really the highest risk when they have increased mobility, increased curiosity, putting things in their mouth, because that's normal behavior.
But I read somewhere that even unborn children, meaning children who are in utero, can be exposed to lead poisoning.
It's an area that we've become much more interested in. OBGYN group has been interested in having pregnant women tested for exposure, either through hobbies or through industrial exposure or a variety of ways. Exactly. And so,
what are the consequences of that? Is it prematurity?
Well, there are animal studies that show that lead can actually cause congenital defects. Those studies are not as clear in the human being, but there are evidence of smaller head size, of prematurity, exactly. So there are some known effects of a lead exposure.
And if they have been exposed, one would think that they also could have some of the same issues, the same sequelae like language or intellectual problems as well.
Exactly.
How about with breastfeeding? If someone has been...
Yeah, that's a great question. We as pediatricians are very strongly supportive of breastfeeding. And so it's a trade-off. You know, if a mother has been exposed and has a measurable blood lead, is it safe for her to feed, because lead will actually pass into the breast milk? I think most of us agree that unless the mother's lead level is fairly high, it's safe to continue breastfeeding. So what's fairly high? It's an arbitrary number. We use 40 micrograms per deciliter. It's almost never seen in an adult anymore.
So given that most cases it's encouraged.
It's safe to continue breastfeeding, right?
So very briefly, so we find lead in things like electronics, you were saying. Is it still found in other things? I know, wasn't there some gaffe about stuff coming through China?
Yeah, about 2 years ago, there was toys, blocks, and so forth. Yeah, and again, it's an example where they don't have a Consumer Product Safety Commission in China that checks every toy to see if they're using excessive amount of lead in the paint. So that was a very big issue. And I don't think very many children got poisoned from that lead exposure, but it did give us an opportunity to highlight the problem of lead poisoning again.
In this country, would you say, how many children do you think have experienced or have lead poisoning?
Oh, there's still millions of children who have elevated blood lead levels. And as I said, if they do drop the acceptable level, we'll have millions more that will fit into that category.
Right.
And unfortunately, this is all what we call secondary prevention. I usually use the example, it's like the canary in the mine. Remember, they used to take a canary into mines, and maybe they still do, to test for, if the canary died, it was the danger of carbon monoxide, get out.
Right.
So why should we be using the child in that way? So ideally, we should be testing the homes before a child gets poisoned and do primary prevention. But that's where you were talking about earlier about a political, economic issue. It's very expensive.
We have to have a tremendous political will, and with the economy being what it is, I doubt that that will happen. Let me ask you very briefly, because I'm aware of the fact that we have a lot to talk about and the time is fleeting. Can you treat lead poisoning? Let's say you find a level in a child.
Yep.
What do you do to treat it, and can you reverse the symptoms?
Well, those are two good questions. One is, yes, there is treatment. It's called chelation. We generally hospitalize a child to do that. It's a 5-day course of treatment. There is an oral...
So you're removing what lead is in their blood.
Well, you take it out of the blood. The problem with lead is it goes into the bone after it's in the blood. So you don't get it out of the bone. You get it out of the blood. So sometimes they require several courses of treatment. Ideally, you want to prevent it in the first place. That's the key. Prevention is obviously the key.
But I'm always thinking, as you're telling me, there are millions of children who qualify.
No, very few treatments. I think in last 2011, we treated in Central New York about a dozen children.
who had levels high enough.
High enough to be hospitalized, right. And that's not just Onondaga County. That's all of Central New York.
But going back to this idea, how do you, I mean, what do you see as the symptoms that would lead you to suspect or even test a child?
Well, that's a good point. New York State and many states mandate testing at 1 and 2 years of age, primarily because you can't find any symptoms. Most children are totally asymptomatic. You cannot tell, looking at a child, oh, this child has a lead level of 20 or 15 or 17 or 32.
So you don't see necessarily hyperactivity or sleeping problems?
Not at those levels, mm-hmm. right. So if you test the child, if we test the child at 1 year of age and he's got a slightly elevated level, then we do that home visit, try to prevent continued exposure. Because that's clearly better. Because the second part of your question was the treatment, unfortunately, doesn't reverse anything. So if damage has occurred, if there's any central nervous system damage, it doesn't get replaced.
So what's the purpose of chelation then?
Well, it's to get the level down, because the higher the level, the more dangerous it is.
So there's further damage would occur
right.
within that body, within
right.
that level.
Right.
So the point is you want to mitigate the level, but you might not be able to reverse any
that's
damage
right.
that's already
that's
been
right.
done.
Right.
That's very well, that's right. important. So what are some of the things that they're suggesting? I see something in some of my notes that I came upon that if a home was built before 1978 was when you really need to take a look at that home and do something about it. What are some of the mitigations?
Well, I just tell you that I think, as I said earlier, primary prevention is the goal. I mean, right now we're at a level where primary prevention really should be our goal. And there are some examples. I mean, I mentioned already taking lead out of gasoline is a form of primary prevention. The legislation in the 70s about leaded paint in homes, that's a primary prevention. Doing lead testing on the children is a form of primary prevention because if you can find...
Catch it early.
So those are things. There are some... There's a law about... I forgot what it's, the title of it is, but when you buy a new house, you have to report whether there's a lead... hazard, so people will know about it ahead of time. Same thing for rentals. You mentioned about other people at risk. One of the other groups that are at risk are new Americans coming into this country from other countries. You know, we have a tremendous refugee resettlement program. It's an excellent program. Many of these youngsters come having been exposed to lead in other countries. So there's a guideline that says, or a rule that says, every child under 16 coming from another country needs to have a lead test within a month of arrival in the States. And then another lead test at 6 months later. Why? Because very often they get settled into an older home which may have a lead hazard. So they may come into this country, get poisoned here. And interestingly, they've just added pregnant women to that recommendation so that a pregnant woman coming from another country should also be tested.
Well, it sounds like we're really getting our arms around this, at least to some degree.
Are you feeling heartened by the results? As I said right at the beginning, this is a public health success story. The unfortunate part is that, as I said, because of all the old housing stock, there is, in fact, still a reservoir of this problem which will go way into the future.
And there's really no way to change that at this point without tremendous expenditures.
Expenditure, right.
Well, but... It seems like public health education would go a long way in terms of the people who have to live in these circumstances in terms of avoiding their children on the floor and taking lead paint in their mouths and what
have you. Right, and the local county health departments do a terrific job of that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing these really important facts with us. My guest has been Dr. Howard Weinberger, professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of the Central Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Research Center. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more HealthLink right after the news. I'm Linda Cohen. This is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.